I want to jump right in where we left off. We covered six things that we learned that Job teaches us about adversity. Here's the seventh one I want to highlight before we move to the next section of our thoughts this afternoon, and that is this. Trusting God when no earthly explanation can be given for why we are suffering is the crowning mark of faith and obedience. I want to say that again. Trusting God when no earthly explanation can be given for why we are suffering is the crowning mark of faith and obedience. You know, a major goal for every Christian is the hope of reaching maturity before death overtakes us. Heard one man say that a commendable etching on a gravestone would be, quote, "Here lies a man who kept growing as he kept aging." Growing up and growing old should go hand in hand, but make no mistake about it. Maturing is a difficult, long, arduous process, but Job reached that in his life. As a matter of fact, it'd be interesting if we had time to look at Job 42, 1 through 6, and also verses 16 and 7 to see the very enviable way in which this great man finished his life. The point is this, when trouble comes into our lives, we really have two options. Number one, we can view it as an intrusion, or number two, we can see it as an opportunity to respond in specific obedience to God's will. That's what Job did. That's exactly what we should do as well. That, to me, is the crowning mark of one's faith. And in James chapter 5 and verse 11, the Bible writer there describes the word as endurance, not patience. That's the word, English word there, but the actual word there is endurance, and it's given to none other than Job himself. I think it's important to remember this. Oswald Chambers made this interesting statement. He said, quote, "Choosing suffering makes no sense at all." That's true, but watch. "To choose God's will in the midst of our suffering makes all the sense in the world." That's the highlight, the point I want to emphasize there. Let me close out with this statement here with reference to these 7 points on Job. A professor of history once said that if Columbus had turned back, no one would have blamed him. But no one would have remembered him either, he said. The single reason that you and I have such admiration for Job is because he endured, and that to the end. What a beautiful, great Bible character, this man Job. What about the biblical concept of adversity as it's presented in the book of Hebrews? Well, in the book, I have a detailed discussion about that. I really think it's important that I at least make the applications for the second part of this lesson. And so I want to move from the way adversity is mentioned in the book of Hebrews to some lessons that we can learn as we apply this lesson this afternoon. What about the value of adversity and pain? There are many lessons that can be learned. I want to highlight several of them for your consideration this afternoon. Number one, suffering helps clarify our priorities and focus on the right objectives. Suffering helps clarify our priorities and focus on the right objectives. The point is this, the deeper the pain, the clearer the vision. The harder we suffer, the more we understand about why life really matters, how important life really is to us, as I should say. And it is during this process that we replace knowledge with wisdom, which is exactly what God wants us to have. And every year about during the time of September, around the 11th, our minds go back and we start thinking about the terrible events that transpired on that fateful day when well over 3,000 people lost their lives. It's not uncommon to turn on the television set and listen to individuals give testimony, survivors who survived those tragic events or had loved ones who died in those events, as they talk about the lessons that they learned and the renewed commitments and priorities they have come to in their lives. As a matter of fact, one surviving New York policeman said this, quote, "As a result of those atrocities, I will never again take our liberty for granted." You see, he learned a good lesson. One middle-aged widow whose husband was killed in the World Trade Center expressed it this way. She said, "I now hug my children tightly every day. I always tell them I love them every morning and every evening before we go to bed." One 48-year-old stockbroker who lost several co-workers on 9/11 admitted, quote, "Listen, I've decided to hold my business and my career much more loosely." Did you catch that word? "My family and friends have now become more important to me." The point is this, suffering has a way of clearing away the fog that prosperity and success creates in our lives. This clears it right away. I have never seen a once professional, successful businessman dying of cancer on his deathbed saying, "I wish I had spent more time at the office." Never seen it, and you will never see it either. You see, suffering has a way of refocusing our priorities, the things that really matter in life. Matthew 6, 19 through 21 teaches us to lay up for ourselves treasures where? In heaven, not on the earth. And suffering has a way of clearing away all of that mess out of our lives. There are some good lessons that could be learned from suffering. You don't think about material things when you're hanging onto life by a thread, in other words. You see, death gives you the kind of wisdom to open up a whole new way of seeing things. Solomon reminds us of this in Ecclesiastes 7, verses 2 to 4, if you want to turn there. I'm going to highlight some points from here. In Ecclesiastes 7, beginning at verse 2, here's what he says. Listen to this. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by the sadness of the heart countenance the heart is made better. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of pleasure. Look at verse 2 again. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. Now, if we were to translate that into modern-day vernacular, it would say this. It is better to go to a funeral home than to gorge oneself at a fellowship meal. It is better to go to a funeral home than to feast. It is better to go to a funeral home or to a stroll through a graveyard for 30 minutes than to spend an entire day at Six Flags. If we want to put it in modern-day terminology, that's what he's saying. Now, why? Why is it better to go to a funeral home than to go to a party, especially in our day and age where we live in a time of feasting and fun and games? What kind of wisdom does a funeral home offer to those who go there? Plenty. And Solomon gives two reasons. Look at the text. He says, for that is the end of all men, number one, but then watch. And number two, the living will lay it to his heart. One thing is certain. The atmosphere within a funeral home prevents one's mind from wandering. Nobody looks at their watches during a funeral. Nobody gets up and goes out into the foyer during a funeral. Nobody is thinking about when the funeral will end so they can go to the restaurant. The point is this. Everybody's mind is focused on that one single major event in life that all of us will meet, and that's death itself. You see, the living come face to face with their own mortality. It's good. It's better to go to a funeral home than to go to a party. That's what he's saying there. Now look at the next phrase there, verse 4. I love this. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. Solomon says that the wise man is going to be there. He's going to be at that funeral home to reflect, to ponder, to seriously contemplate the things that really matter in life. And what a beautiful concept that is. As a preacher, I have seldom had a wiser audience than during a funeral service. They really listen. It's amazing how much perspective is gained when we see life from the end back, when we catch a glimpse of life from the back door. Death gives you that kind of wisdom. I recently read a true story of a lady who was in one of the lifeboats. The Titanic was in the process of sinking. She made it to one of the lifeboats, and she requested if she could have permission to go back to one of her staterooms to get something that she had left there. And so they told her, listen, you've got 3 minutes, and we're leaving. And so she raced back to her stateroom. The deck had already been slanting in an angle that was dangerous. She crosses through one of the gambling rooms there, and all of the money had been pushed over to one side, ankle deep. Nobody was picking it up, by the way. Nobody cared. She made it back to her stateroom, pushed aside her expensive bracelets, diamond rings, all of her jewelry, and reached up into a crate and pulled out 3 small oranges and made her way back to the lifeboat just in time. That's incredible, because 30 minutes earlier, she wouldn't have traded an entire crate of oranges for even the smallest diamond. Point is this, death had boarded the Titanic. One blast of its awful breath had transformed every value. Instantaneously, things that were priceless had now become worthless. Things that were worthless had now become priceless. And in that moment, here was a lady who preferred 3 small oranges to an entire crate of diamonds. Death gives you that kind of wisdom. You see, ladies and gentlemen, it's important for us to recognize that principle. Perish the thought, folks, but listen to me. You get a terminal illness, and it is remarkable what you will start doing with your time. It is remarkable how valuable your family becomes to you. It is remarkable how much less time you spend at the office. It is remarkable how valuable Bible study becomes to you. It is remarkable how much Wednesday night service becomes to you. No longer are you found shopping on Wednesday nights. No longer are you found on the lake on Sunday morning. You see, ladies and gentlemen, death gives you that kind of wisdom. It's better to go to a funeral home than to go to a party. Coming face to face with the grim reaper himself has a way of clearing away the fog that worldliness creates in our lives. Solomon continues in verse 3. Look at what he says. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by the sadness of the countenance of the heart is made better. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. Now watch. But the heart of fools is in the house of pleasure. We seldom think any more shallow than when some clown casts a joke into our heads. But it's amazing how quickly we forget the joke. But you don't forget a 30-minute stroll through a cemetery. You don't forget the lives of great men and women who shaped lives for good. Words fail you as you move from one stone to the next. Pondering maybe a grandfather who shaped a life. Pondering the life of a grandmother or a son or a daughter or maybe a preacher or an elder who did something in their life that has changed your life for better. It's better to go to a funeral home than to go to a party. Malcolm Muggeridge writes these words, quote, "Contrary to what might be expected, I look back on experiences that at the time seemed especially desolating and painful with particular satisfaction. Indeed, I can say with complete truthfulness that everything I have learned in my 75 years in this world, everything that has truly enhanced and enlightened my existence, has been through affliction and not through happiness." Remember, the deeper the pain, the clearer the vision. Job teaches us that. Adversity has a way of quickly turning our focus on a vertical plane. Here's number two. In the second place, suffering helps us appreciate the things that we value. Suffering helps us appreciate the value of things easily forgotten. One of our members recently broke her arm, and the nature of her occupation demands the uses of both of her hands. And she was realizing just how valuable that hand was to her. She remarked to me, "Jason, I never realized just how much I needed my arm until I broke it." That's true. You see, we seldom think about the value of something until we lose it or it's not functioning properly. But folks, suffering has a way of jolting us back into reality, reminding us of just how valuable those things are. It may be a hand. It may be a loved one. It may be a friend. It may be any number of things that we sometimes take for granted. Number three, suffering reminds us this earth was never intended by God to be our permanent dwelling place. I love that. Any discussion on human suffering, heaven has the final answer, the most important answer. That's when all of this will finally come to an end. In Romans 8 and verse 18, the Bible says, "For I reckon that the sufferings of this present world are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed in us. Indeed, this world is not my home," as we sometimes sing. Think about this. If this world was completely void of suffering, you and I would have no desire to leave it. None at all. Not the slightest bit at all to leave this place. There's benefits to pain. There's benefits to suffering. It reminds us that God never intended this earth to be our permanent dwelling place. Even the notorious Bertrand Russell, the skeptic, said this, quote, "The center of me is always an eternally and terrible pain, a curious wild pain, a searching for something beyond what the world contains." What a tragedy, never found it. But even within him, this skeptic, he realized there was something beyond this life. Philip Yancey writes these words, quote, "The Bible never belittles human disappointment. Remember the proportion of Job. One chapter of restoration follows 41 chapters of anguish, but it does add one key word, temporary. What we feel now, we will not always feel. Our disappointment is itself a sign, an aching, a hunger for something better. And faith is, in the end, a kind of homesickness for a home we have never visited, but have never once stopped longing for." Listen, folks, suffering has a way of drawing our interest to a place where pain will not be there. Revelation 21 and verse 4. Number four, and many of us will identify with this principle right here. Suffering has a way of breaking a rebellious spirit, bringing the sinner closer to God. In Psalm 119, verse 67, David said, listen to what he says here. Before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I've kept your word. In a few verses later, he says, it is good for me that I've been afflicted. Why? That I might learn thy statutes, verse 71. Affliction is good when it draws us closer to God. It is amazing what will happen to the heart of an unfaithful child of God the night before his triple bypass surgery. Amazing indeed. You've seen it. Oh, yes. You know exactly what I'm talking about. Invariably, his attention has now become vertical. You see, when a person is lying in a bed horizontally in pain, invariably their attention becomes vertical. They're now thinking about things that really matter in life. You've seen it happen. It may have happened to some of you before. You see, God can get your attention in various ways, and chastening is one of them. Hebrews 12, 5 through 11. When sinners are forced to stare at a hospital ceiling, it is not uncommon for their existing relationship with God to occupy their thoughts. The rebellious son in Luke chapter 15 teaches us that. When he finally came to the end of himself, you remember what happened? He made the journey home. You see, reality quickly took root in the young rebel's heart. He was now thinking about the home he left, the father he left, I should say, and the relationship that he wanted to have again. It's very important for us to recognize that suffering can break a rebellious spirit, bringing the sinner closer to God. Some years ago, I was listening to the radio, heard a man say this, I've never forgotten this, quote, listen to this, I use this in Lubbock. He said, pain plants the flag of reality in the fortress of a rebel's heart. Pain plants the flag of reality in the fortress of a rebel's heart. C.S. Lewis described it like this. Listen to what he says. God whispers to us in our pleasures, but he shouts to us in our pain. It is his megaphone to arouse a deaf world. He can get your attention. That brings us to this concept right here. Number five. Suffering has a way of uniting. I love this principle. Suffering has a way of uniting people on a single thread of human compassion and courtesy. Do you believe that? One writer said this, if you doubt the megaphone value of suffering, I mentioned C.S. Lewis, he's commenting about what he said. If you doubt the megaphone value of suffering, I recommend that you visit the intensive care ward of a hospital. There you'll find all sorts of people pacing the lobby, a mixture of rich, poor, beautiful, plain, black, white, smart, dull, spiritual, atheistic, white-collar, blue-collar. But the intensive care ward is the one place in the world where none of these divisions make a speck of difference. In an intensive care ward, all visitors are united by a single awful thread. Concern over a dying relative or friend. Economic difference, fade away. You'll see no sparks of racial tension there. Sometimes strangers will console one another or cry together quietly and unashamedly. All are facing life at its most essential. Only the megaphone of suffering is strong enough to bring these people to their knees to ponder ultimate questions of life and death and meaning. Is that true? Right on target. Even feuding family members who sit on opposite sides in a church building will find themselves sitting right next to each other when their mommy and daddy dies. Or their grandpa or grandmother dies. They'll be sitting right next to each other at a funeral service. The point is this. Suffering has a way of eliminating strife and hatred even from some of the hardest of hearts. They won't sit on opposite sides at a funeral, but they will do in a worship service, but they'll be right together during a funeral. There's benefits to pain. Make no mistake about it. I've seen it happen. I have seen that very thing happen where individuals wouldn't talk to each other during worship services, but they're hugging at a funeral service. It's better to go to a funeral home than a party. Make no mistake about it. Make no mistake about it. Number six, suffering enhances our ability to pray. Wayne Jackson writes, praying is an instinctive response to severe hardship. Even when Jesus was in the shadow of the cross, we see this principle, Luke chapter 24 and verse, or 22 and 44. He prayed more earnestly, and as his sweat was, it were great drops of blood falling to the ground. Listen, folks, if hardship drove Jesus to his knees in fervent prayer, can you and I afford to do anything less? when he's our perfect example in all things, 1 Peter 2:21 and 1 John 2 and verse 6. Number 7, suffering nurtures the noblest qualities of which mankind is capable. Wayne Jackson is the author of these last few points here. It is very difficult for one to cultivate the quality of courage in the absence of fear. You ever thought about that? The traits of love and sorrow cannot be fully appreciated in the absence of apathy and joy, or apathy and sorrow, I should say. Those things have to be there for us to appreciate the concept of those things. Endurance cannot be practiced in the absence of adversity, James 1, 2 through 4. And so suffering actually nurtures the noblest qualities of which you and I can maintain in our lives or have in our lives. And number 8, suffering prepares the soul for eternity. 1 Peter chapter 1, beginning at verse 6. The Bible says, "Wherein ye greatly rejoice, though now for a season. If need be, you are in heaviness through manifold temptations, that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ, whom having not seen you love, in whom, though now you see him not, yet believing, ye rejoice with joy unspeakable and full of glory, receiving the end of your faith, even the salvation of your souls." Folks, suffering prepares the soul for eternity. In a shortened expression of Peter's remarks here, Job wrote these words in Job 23 and verse 10. Here's what he said. He says this, listen, what a remarkable statement. "But he knoweth the way that I take, and when he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold." What a grand statement. In other words, I will emerge a better person. There will be gold-like qualities that will emerge after this affliction occurs in my life. That's what he says there. You know, he doesn't doubt or deny the trials. He just recognizes there's hope beyond them. He knows that God knows, and he's going to reward. And that's exactly what we find in the very end of Job's life. God knew, and he rewarded at the very end. But it was going to be done on his time and not Job's time. Look at those words in Job 23 and verse 10 again, because there's three very critical observations that we learn from his statement. Listen to what he says again. He says that he knows the way that I take, and when I shall come forth, when he tried me, I should say, I shall come forth as gold. Listen to this. Number one, he states that I know that God knows my situation. He knows yours. He knoweth the way that I take. Look at the faith he has. Number two, I believe it is God who is testing me when he hath tried me, he says. And then number three, I believe after the trials have ended, he will bless me in a unique way. I shall come forth as gold. Ladies and gentlemen, that is faith at its deepest level. And Job made it. He was there. What a remarkable character in the Bible. You know, wouldn't it be great for us to be in Job's position at the end of the book without going through what he went through in the book? Wouldn't it be just marvelous for us to gain the wisdom he gained without all of the suffering he experienced? Don't nod your head in approval. It's not going to happen. We must be realistic. It's not going to happen. It takes fire to refine gold. Suffering has a way of removing the ugly impurities of the soul, molding, preparing, and shaping that whole soul for the incorruptible inheritance that awaits it. 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 4. There is no crown of righteousness without the crown or cross of adversity. There's no way. There's no way. As we conclude here, I think you would agree that no honest person will dispute that life at times is unfair. You know, one will search their Bible in vain to see Jesus denying unfairness. You ever thought about that? He doesn't deny the concept of unfairness. When Jesus encountered a sick person, he never delivered a lecture about accepting your lot in life. He healed the person. When Jesus encountered a person that was in deep pain, he was moved with compassion. In John chapter 11 and verse 35, when his own friend died, the Bible says he wept. Even when he himself was going through suffering, in Luke chapter 22 in the Garden of Gethsemane, he recoiled from that. He didn't want that, praying fervently, what? That if there was any way possible. Is life on earth unfair? The answer depends on how closely we identify God in life. Surely life on earth is unfair. The cross settled that issue forever. Let me close with this illustration. Author Henry Nguyen tells the story of a family in Paraguay. The father, who was a doctor, was speaking out against the military regimes of that time and their human rights abuses. And so to get him back, the police officers arrested his son and tortured him to death. The villagers wanted to use his funeral as a public protest in what had done, in what was taken, what had taken place. But the father had another way of showing the despicable behavior of those who killed his son. He was going to protest in a totally different way. And so he took the body as it was displayed in the jail, naked, scarred from the electric shocks and cigarette burns and beatings. And all the villagers filed past the corpse, which lay not in a coffin, but on the blood-soaked mattress that he found in the jail. One writer says this, quote, "It was the strongest protest imaginable. Listen, for it put injustice on grotesque display." That is exactly what happened at Calvary. Have you ever thought about that? The blood-soaked cross that held Jesus' body naked and scarred exposed all of the violence and injustice of this world. And at that moment in history, listen, the cross revealed what kind of world we have and what kind of God we have. A world of gross unfairness and a God of sacrificial love. Is life unfair? Make no mistake about it. The cross settled that issue forever. No one is exempt from tragedy and disappointment. Jesus did not offer a way around adversity and pain. He only offered a way through it to the other side. And his own bloody cross provided that way. In the Old Testament, one of God's heroes suffered. His name was Job. In the New Testament, one of God's own, his only begotten son, suffered even more. If anyone knows about the subject of human suffering, it is the God of heaven. He knows what it's all about. A truth that even Job himself would now freely admit from the bliss of paradise. You know, I've often wondered what Job perhaps said the very first moment after those angels escorted his spirit to the paradise compartment of Hades. Perhaps maybe he said something like this. So this was the reason why. Make no mistake about it. Heaven will surely be worth it all. Make no mistake about it. Well, we have some questions now. One question that has been asked. I appreciate your nice attention. And you may want to come to the microphone and add some comments to what we've said in this lesson. And I do a question and answer service, but it's not live where I preach. Well, it is live, excuse me. It is live. But it's not live in the sense of someone walking down to a microphone. It's they hand me the questions and then I study them, and then on a PowerPoint presentation I know what the questions are. So if you come down to the microphone, if I look nervous, it's because I have no idea what you may be asking. And I'll just be honest with you, I may not know the answer to your question. So someone else in the assembly, Michael Light, Barry, Devin, anybody else, Joey, anybody else can come forward, Brother Ratcliffe, and maybe could help out if I don't know the answer to your question. But here's a question that someone has asked. It says, how do we as Christians pray for one who is terminally ill? And then in parentheses it says, not a New Testament Christian. Well, the first thing that I would pray for is that for that New Testament Christian to have God spare them long enough for you to continue conversing with them about things that really matter. That may be a good starting point, because obviously if this person is terminally ill and they still have their faculties and they're able to study with you, and then praying for their life to be spared would not be a bad thing to pray for, because we know this person is lost, as the individual has mentioned in this question. So longevity of life would be the first thing I would want to pray for, and then perhaps an open heart to the things that I would teach that individual about the gospel of Christ. But what about an individual who is at the point where they are terminally ill, to the point that they may not be able to have a Bible study with you? Well, that's a different question, and obviously that person is incapable of having a Bible study with you, then really, there's really nothing that you can do at that point. Perhaps maybe you can pray for some of the surviving family members at that time, that maybe some benefit or good can result from this, that they will be receptive and open to the things that you have to say. I think finishing our prayers with whatever your will be, Lord, is what we want, would be probably the best way to handle that situation. That's not an easy question, and there may be someone else who wants to add something to that. And like I said, one of these gentlemen may want to come forward at this time and do that. If not, there may be another question that someone might have at this point. If that's you, we'll open the microphone up to you at this time. If not, I've got 47 more pages to cover. No, I'm kidding. I thank you so much for your kind attention. I love and appreciate the people that you are.